Welcome to the Bully Pulpit from the University of Southern California Center for the Political Future. Our podcast brings together America's top politicians, journalists, academics, and strategists from across the political spectrum for discussions on hot-button issues where we respect each other and respect the truth. We hope you enjoy these conversations.
Thank you to UFC for having us. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Deborah Kahn, California Policy Editor for Politico and editor of our daily newsletter called California Climate, which is free and comes out every day at 6 p.m. So you can sign up. And our lead reporter, Blanca, is here too, chronicling this event. So stay tuned for any news that we make. So this is a really big time for climate policy and California climate policy in particular. As you guys all know, I wasn't going to make any attempts at humor because I think Samantha Bee is here. Although I don't know if she's here. So I'd heard that USC was stood for University of Spoiled Children. But this event is so nice that I think it should also stand for University of Spoiled Adults. So anyway, okay.
It doesn't seem.
We'll start with just our really good, illustrious slate of panelists here. So we got Kenzen Seldon, who is founder and managing partner of Pulse Fund, which is a venture capital fund that invests in climate companies. Mm-hmm. And are you based in LA?
I am.
Okay.
Recently based in LA and moved from San Francisco, which feels like LA feels like a new state.
It is. It really is. So you didn't have a very large carbon footprint to get here, yes. Unlike Joanne Woody, who came here from New York. She's a lawyer, New York City administrator, environmentalist. If you Google her, you'll find out that she helped create the Brooklyn Bridge Park, and she wrote a book about it, and she knows a lot about permitting and patience and how things actually happen in a bureaucracy in a giant metropolis. But she's also a longtime League of Conservation Voters board member and co-chair of Environmental Defense Fund's Political Action Committee. So she's got a lot of different hats, and we're really happy to have her. And then we have former state senator Fran Pavley, who served in the California legislature from 2000 to 2016, very pivotal time. And she was before that a teacher, I think for 29 years in a middle school, right?
I think the middle school helped you in the legislature.
Yes.
Smooth transition. Exactly.
Absolutely.
So you have a lot of experience in patience as well. And you wrote AB 32, the original law that gave California the authority to mandate greenhouse gas emissions reduction. Like I said, a panel full of luminaries, and we're really excited, and we'll save the last 15 minutes for questions. So I just want to start by highlighting something that we, Politico, just reported, Blanca reported last week, that I think perfectly illustrates what the stakes are in this election. So our story said that Donald Trump is going to go immediately attempt to withdraw California's ability to go further than the feds on vehicle emission standards. She got a quote from Trump's campaign explicitly saying that. So it's just all out there. And we got into what the governor is doing to prepare for it, like making deals with automakers to keep following California's laws, even if they're challenged. Newsom just made one 2 weeks ago with Stellantis, which was the peg for our story. So it's all just happening. Like, things are happening right now, right? We're not mm-hmm. waiting. We're not like, oh, what's going to happen? Like things are already changing right now in response to Trump. So it's already here. Politicians, policymakers changing their decision-making right now in anticipation of it. And so I was thinking we would start with you, Senator Powell. So you wrote not only California's original law requiring it to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you wrote 4 years before that the state's first greenhouse gas standards for vehicles, right? And that was what led to where we are today, because the Bush administration denied a waiver pretty early, 2006, was it? Anyway, you're probably the best person on earth to speak to this, to speak to what's going on right now and how we got here. So just talk about how important these rules are. Statewide, nationwide, globally, and just walk us through the history of the state-federal relationship and maybe hypothesize about why you think there's such a target.
And you'll have to remind me what the cutoff so on this, because there's just an amazing panel here. We're trying to figure out how we can consolidate this.
An hour just on it.
But just as a way of history, California is very unique, and the reason why we've had these laws really came back from the 50s and 60s. Anyone have grandparents or parents or yourself, if you're admitting to be 70 or older, myself, you know how bad our smog was then, worse than today, right? Absolutely. Far worse than today. You had three-stage alerts all the time. You couldn't go outside at school for recess, et cetera, et cetera. So the air pollution was so bad, and it was determined that it was connected to vehicles. And we didn't have that many people in California and that many vehicles. So how could it be so bad? So one of the reasons came out, first of all, so many mothers who cared about their kids were coming and talking to this new governor named Ronald Reagan on do something about this smog, do something about protecting our children. Well, he did. And I want to tell the story because all the heroes at the beginning were all Republicans. Shouldn't be partisan, right, when it comes to public health, especially children and families. And so that's how the California Air Resources Board was created. And some of their first regulatory policies that they implemented include catalytic converters, unleaded gas, and the list goes on and on. Really made a difference. Fast forward about 10 more years, first Earth Day, 1970, Federal Clean Air Act. Who was president? Nixon. I don't think it's a coincidence that both Ronald Reagan and Nixon were from Southern California. They understood that, and Nixon had political reasons too. So in the Federal Clean Air Act, since California's regulations predated that and our smog was so terrible, we have a carve-out in federal law, in federal statute, that says California can pass more stringent tailpipe emission standards, not fuel efficiency standards, tailpipe emission standards than the federal government. Other states have two choices, depending upon how they comply with, I won't go through all the EPA caveats on that. But about 17 other states have joined California in passing our same laws. So as a freshman legislator in 2001 and 2, helpful with EDF and probably half of you in this room, freshman legislator was able to suggest that instead of just regulating criteria air pollutants from the tailpipe of vehicles, let's add greenhouse gas emissions. And so we put a coalition together, and it got passed, barely, by one vote, but that's all it took.
But it was in a Republican administration.
Yes, it was, yes. So this is the problem. You need a waiver from the federal government. The regulations were adopted. We met the compelling and criteria and all the arguments that you need for the waiver. It's usually procedural. President doesn't have to sign anything. Congress doesn't have to approve it. EPA had passed 50 waivers in a row, like for unleaded gas and everything. The Bush administration had denied the waiver. There was also a Supreme Court decision, Massachusetts versus EPA, challenging whether climate pollutants like greenhouse gas emissions could be considered like criteria air pollutants. Even subject to waiver authority, won that 5-4 decision. Fifth vote, Republican from California. There's a theme here. So eventually the bill made its way through. Biden administration, the Obama administration adopted the waiver, worked out an MOU with the Department of Highway Transportation so we don't cross each other as far as fuel efficiency standards. We're moving forward. Trump administration comes into power and takes away our waiver authority. Some of the biggest concerns that we have with this November election, just tying into that, is the promise again to take away California's waiver authority, not only for California, for others. And so that's why you're talking about those deals being made just this month with Stellantis and automobile manufacturers like Fiat and Chrysler and Dodge, added to deals that were already made with automobile manufacturers during the last time the waiver was denied on the Bush administration. And that was with Ford and et cetera, et cetera. And so California is working with the automobile manufacturers. And for all those who had sued to block the regulations, I have to share with you, every year I'm invited to the auto show and they show me all these cars that are successfully being made, EVs, hydrogen fuel cells, you name it, across the spectrum, sold in other countries and states. And we've created a market for investment in clean technologies. And the automobile manufacturers realizing with our population and marketing base here in California, they want to work with us. I think they know the public is behind us and they're making agreements that they will be not part of any lawsuit that is in favor of getting rid of California's unique statute under the Federal Clean Air Act. And I hope that stands. And we're worried about the Supreme Court decision and everything else being overturned. So this election really matters. If you care about air pollution, if you care about climate change, it's all tied up into this. California's unique place on vehicles under the Clean Air Act really has made a difference.
Yeah. So if we have such, and thank you for all that history, if we have these agreements with automakers to kind of insulate us, you know, insulate California legally, how important is the election then?
It will be incredibly important because they could go back and just even look at whether other states have the ability to still do that. And could they still go through the courts? And then the mixed market signals to the automobile manufacturers. They're committed globally. We're seeing incredible amount of interest here in California. We all need to do a better job, though, in putting the EV infrastructure in and everything else that's holding people back. We have a lot of work to do. But mobile source emissions, I think getting to the crux of the problem, is 40 to 50% of all our greenhouse gas emissions, let alone our criteria air pollution. So in California, this is an incredibly important election. We have to focus on Congress and everything else in California and some of those seats, but nationally as well, and tell the story, as Arnold would say, we're not just talking about climate pollution, we're talking about air pollution, we're talking about public health for your children and your families. And the PPIC polls done every year on the environment show when it comes to air quality and air pollution and public health, it crosses partisan lines.
Yes.
So messaging is really important and coalition building. So that's why I'm really pleased to be here today, because this is the year to put back that coalition of economic investors, new clean technologies, job base, interfaith council. I mean, we had amazing coalitions to pass these bills to begin with. We need them back, and we need a revolution on the university and college level for students to get engaged as well. They're going to own this.
We will get into that too. Tenzin, you have thoughts?
Yes, I do. I think that so grateful for Senator, your work around the legislation. And I think from the private sector perspective, I've been a founder in the climate space. I've been at UN Environmental Program. So really had a bird's eye view, and I'm a venture capitalist, which I know for the public, we may not have the best reputation. But what I will say is that governance matters so deeply, because without the right policy and political structures, I have often found that companies don't have a way of actually being able to be verified, vetted, and also have accountability. And so we have found, though, there is a misalignment of financing. For example, 40% of financing in the last 2022 to 2023 in venture capital and private equity in green energy went into electric vehicles, 40%. And yet for carbon accounting, it's 15% of carbon emission. Again, I don't see there's anything wrong with the fact that we are spending so much money on electric vehicles. But at this point, investors are not able to even get the return on investment because we don't have a grid to support it. So the misalignment of capital allocation is something that has to be embedded and corrected both in the private markets, but also I think in incentivization programs. So today I was very, very heartened to see that President Biden announced $20 billion mandate to be able to give coalition leaders for climate justice work so that private companies that are working with marginalized groups can also get financing. Because what I don't see financing is on natural-based solutions. Soil is still the quickest way to decarbonize our planet, and yet less than 1% of financing goes in soil. Why is there such a misalignment? I'd love for the audience to think about that. And your dollar and your voice matters, because this is where you are able to actually put in that vetting power.
Thanks. Everyone think about that, and let's have some robust. I mean, I wonder, like, is it like soil? Is there's not enough profit there? I mean,
there is profit. We at Pulse Fund, we invested in a company called Mass Reforestation, which is using reforestation as a service. And they work on soil building, and they've found time and time again that land, as we all know, wildfires has increased in the Pacific Northwest up to 600% and expected to increase 750%. Our residents in Malibu cannot even get insurance because of wildfires. This is a consequential effect on our economy and our political system and on even the lands we buy. Why isn't there financing? It's because we don't right now have enough catalytic investment. We need government investment in projects that are required, like wildfire protection and companies that work on it. So there are enough companies and I think enough profits, but it's just mismanagement.
Okay. Let's keep talking about companies. Especially, I'm really interested in Joanne's perspective here, because you have worked for EDF for a really long time, and they pride themselves on pitching a big tent and being bipartisan. How realistic is that going to continue to be if Trump wins? Is there anything you can do at that point?
I think the answer to that is that we can't. We can't let him win. It's that basic. We already know what he wants to do. He already did it in his first term, and he's going to do it again. He's talking about it openly. It's on his website. And he is going to roll back everything that was done in California, tailpipe, air, power plants, scientists. He doesn't believe in climate change, and he's going to convert the employees of EPA. He sent some of them to the Midwest the last time he was president. And this time they're just going to be no longer public servants. They're going to be replaced by a cadre of people who work for him. And so I think it's fairly A, frightening, and B, well disclosed what we can expect from Trump. And that being the case, I think that to replace a president that has been the best ever president on climate, as Neera outlined, with all of, not just did he have these, not he didn't just run on climate, which he did. He then actually put forward, as soon as he got into office, a lot of these proposals, and has been working very hard to pass them, which was not easy. Mm. It took a lot of sophistication on his part because of his long years serving in Congress to get people together and to get the right people to agree at the right time to get this legislation passed. And as she said, mm-hmm. for the IRA, the infrastructure bill, the inflation bill, not a single Republican voted for this. And so when we're looking at a situation where the Republicans now hold the House, maybe the Democrats can take the House back. They certainly have a plan to do it. It's not implausible that they could do it, but it won't be easy to do. The Democrats are on the edge in the Senate, which they now hold, because so many people Democrats are up and retirements. And mm-hmm. so if we end up with a trifecta for Republicans, which we very well could if Trump is elected, we're toast. I don't know any other way to say it. And there's no good reaction. Mm. There's nothing we can do to undo the Trump vision for climate. We're not going to change his mind. The only way we're going to change his mind is if we don't elect him. And so I would say the stakes for this election are extraordinarily high, because we risk everything. Every single thing that we've done on climate, it will be up for grabs if this man is elected. And it will be devastating, not just for today, but for the future. We know how much damage he can do in 4 short years. And what worries me is that the lack of education on a lot of voters about, first of all, the economy. When they think about the economy and they're worried about prices, rising prices or not falling prices, this is on their mind, obviously. We know it is. Even if people care about the climate, they're always going to be more concerned about their bread and butter issues and how they eat and how they take care of their health and housing. These are all going to be in conflict in their head to some extent with climate, because their heads are stuffed with disinformation about the fact that addressing climate will be expensive. It will cost money. It will hurt you individually. And at the same time, not understanding exactly beyond the theoretical how they are going to benefit directly in their everyday life from whatever the climate programs are going to produce for them. I think the workforce is extremely important, but it's still very small and it will roll out over a long period of time. And I think it also has to be focused on communities that are not now voting. There are going to be more than 8 million young people eligible to vote in the next election. And 45% of them are going to be people of color. We need those people educated, feeling they have a stake, they're going to get something out of this, and voting. We need to get them to understand they need to become habitual voters, which they are not. So I think we have a lot of work to do. My fear is that not that we'll all say poo-poo, the climate's not so important, but that we'll not understand the fears of the majority of the voters about their economic threat. And if you think that these car companies are not doing it, they are. They've told them, they first said that they've had a reduction, they say, in EV purchases, and that they're now backing off of some production. I don't know whether it will be significant enough to really matter, but they are putting in the heads of a lot of people, because I see polling and focus group information all the time. They are definitely putting in the head of working people that this is going to cost them money, and that scares them. And we don't know how they're going to vote, or whether they'll turn out to vote, or the independents who have such a strong decision factor, because we do have polarization. The independents will make a difference. If youth comes out, they'll make a difference. If infrequent voters come out, they'll make a difference. We have to make sure all these people understand they're being bamboozled.
Yeah, Kenton.
I was just going to say that while I agree with you, I think a healthy bit of conflict to me adds value. And I think that this climate issue, as we all know, it's not a Republican or Democratic issue. It is a human issue. 2030, the reason why all of these climate activists and leaders always rely on 2030 is the 1.5 degree Celsius change, which will, if we meet that point, it will mark a time of catastrophic climate events that we are already seeing right now. The migration of hundreds of millions of people expected as a result of heat waves and whatnot. And while I understand that and this is a consequential election, I also think that what it does, it has already, as I've seen, is activated communities of color. It has activated local communities. I've seen in San Francisco, for example, for the last 4 years, a lot of Los Angeles residents talk about how San Franciscans are so disempowered politically, but yet during this local election, I saw the fact that climate was the number one on the agenda, and people are investing in the local community because they feel that this is the one place that they have agency. I also, in my experience, want to talk about climate perfectionism, because as someone who's been in this movement for a very long time, it has been excruciatingly difficult to see the fact that those who are trying consistently get bogged down. I work with climate-aligned founders who want to do more, but they're scared because the skeptics and activists are getting louder. And again, I think there's a real room for a climate activist. I used to be one. But I also find that the level of perfectionism of wanting to achieve everything to be perfect can sometimes get in the way of us actually achieving anything. So
I don't disagree with that. I think a lot of people... An interesting thing we've found is that if you look at the numbers on how people judge Biden on his climate performance, good, and Trump on his climate performance, not so good, but on energy, Trump performs off the chart and Biden is nowhere.
Off the chart, so, good or bad?
No. But what happens is that people think, Why is Trump better on energy? He's better because he is in favor of drilling. And they think if he's in favor of drilling, that means gas prices are going to come down.
Well, isn't it also, I mean, it's also the case that under Biden, the U.S. is the biggest natural gas and crude oil producer.
Exactly.
In the world,
but most people don't know that. They, in polls, they say, well, why isn't he more in the center? Why isn't he all of the above? He is all of the above. And he's actually done more drilling than any president so far.
Is that something you think he should play up more?
Well, it's an issue, right? A lot of people would say, oh my God, if they knew that. On the other hand, I think people do have to be realistic. Mm-hmm. And you have to make people who are scared economically understand that the transition is not going to occur overnight, that they're not all going to lose their jobs tomorrow. They're not all going to have to buy electric vehicles. They're not going to have any choice about their electric vehicle or any car. The government's going to decide. They have to understand that this will take time. And they're not at danger at this moment. It's not a reason to back off of climate.
So is it, let's talk about the youth a little bit more, because they're very fired up and some of them have read our story, a couple weeks ago that pointed out that Biden is pursuing an all of the above strategy, which is risking turning off people on the left and the right. But you're going for kind of the established voters with a strategy like that, right? I mean, you've got the younger voters who want him to be all about climate. And then he's not, right? So what's the best way to communicate that?
I think he has to appeal to the working person. And that's most of the voters.
Okay. What do you think?
I don't think we can dismiss the youth here. We found Gen Z and millennials time and time again. Pew Research just found that 85% are saying that climate is their number one issue because for them it's a consequential threat. So, and given that, as you rightly pointed out, that they are becoming a more majority stakeholding in terms of election, I think that there is a real serious process and problem of communication and misdirecting communication between both intergenerationally and also where, as I said, a lot of young people are using climate activism and sometimes radical forms of climate activism. We have seen that climate violence, meaning using violence as a form of protest, has increased up to 25% in the last 3 years. Why is that? Violence is typically used when there is a form of feeling as though they're unsubjected to having their voice heard. And so what are constructive platforms? And I have seen a couple of examples. I think Norway does this really well. Bhutan does this really well. Bhutan, every week on Fridays, holds intergenerational sessions where young people can speak to the elderly to figure out ways to actually work together to protect the environment. How come we don't have things like this instituted? These are small political and local educational changes, but I think they're highly effective.
Well, I agree with you. And I agree, moreover, that this has to be a bottom-up operation.
Right.
It can't be a top-down operation because people listen to their trusted messengers. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is having conversations and developing trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's extremely important. And those, a lot of those communities, no one's talking to right
yes.
now. So we have to figure out a way to talk to them or else they're not going to vote either.
An ongoing question and how things happen actually is the bottom up. And so in your local schools, houses of worship, whatever it is, local cities,
right.
getting youth. Yes, and everyone else involved in projects that can make a difference in their community and they can see it. I mean, putting in, energy efficient windows can help reduce your temperatures in your home mm-hmm. and save on greenhouse gas emissions. That's a win-win. You reduce it. So finding things you can do, putting in the shade, extreme heat. We're now right. spending as much time and money on adaptation as we are on mitigation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is a hard balance, but I think you have to feel that you can't wait on Washington, D.C. That's what I learned in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. We waited on Washington, D.C. Not one piece of legislation has passed in the last 30 years on climate. You can't get it through who's ever president.
Yeah, this is a very
Congress.
Important election, right?
And so, but people need to feel they can make a difference at home and not just Biden versus Trump. It's a lot broader than that. And developing strategies in the workforce and one thing I did is put climate education in the K-12 curriculum and science textbooks and things. It's not preaching kind of thing, but just looking at it from science-based, but also
the jobs potential as we are in a revolution in a new technology for the future based not on fossil fuels, but cleaner fuels. And we don't want to be dependent on other countries for our well-being. So I'm all for
bottom up.
And they can see things make a difference.
Yes.
You can start to see it on college campuses subtly and things like that. And then they can realize how you put these coalitions together to push their elected officials to do the right thing.
I think the way that we shape the language around climate, in my opinion, has been devastating and filled with grief. And I take some responsibility as someone who's been in this space for a long time. And we had a couple of gatherings with climate leaders in several years. And the question was posed, what are we doing where only the same individuals are hearing the message and we're not going to the wider audience? And it was a real moment of self-reflection for us. And the answer we came to is because we're communicating with grief instead of opportunity. And if you actually look at it in just raw statistics, I was a math minor, so for me, I love numbers, is that fossil-based systems are actually, in terms of energy, can waste up to 68% of energy even in buildings. So it's just not a good system, even in unit economic cost. Whereas natural-based systems and clean energy-based systems are, they're not just good because it's good for the planet. They're actually good for the fact of energy usage and unit economics. But we have never communicated this message in a way that is positive and in a way that is with opportunity. And I think this is something where some other countries, I feel like, as I said, some of the Nordic countries and Europe have communicated climate message in a way that is not about grief and depression and about saying what we have done wrong, but on focusing on where we can go and what we have done right.
And I think,
celebrating successes.
Exactly.
That was the beginning of today. And that's part of it. We fall back in defending rather than, moving forward.
But on the, on your point about the way in which you motivate people, I think EDF's work on, with corporations has been really interesting because it's not, there is a profit motive, but there are a lot of companies that are actually very interested in the concept, but also they welcome expertise in learning how they can both do well and do good, or do good and do well, I guess is really what I mean. And that is that they can make changes in their operations and in their supply chains, in which case they impact a very large number of people and a very large scope. And they can also save money. Mm-hmm. And their employees are happy and everyone feels good about coming to work. And I think that there are plenty of corporations like that out there. And EDF has worked with many of them.
Yeah.
But I think there's also what you raised earlier, which is the issue of accountability. Mm-hmm. Promises and good feelings don't always do it. You have to hold people accountable, set a metric and hold them accountable. And we just launched this last month, the methane satellite, mm-hmm. which is designed to do precisely that. At the COP in Doha, the state oil companies agreed to start to contain methane. And the way we're going to hold them accountable is because this satellite is flying around the world and it can see right down on the ground where the methane is coming from. And so we'll know whether they are keeping their promises or not. But we have to do it in a nice way so that we encourage them to do it instead of beating them over the head. But in any event, I just think that it's the same methodology that we talk about with mm-hmm. bottom up with people applies to corporations, that we shouldn't demonize them and assume that they're bad people that don't want to do the right thing.
Critical.
We should treat it as an opportunity to help them save money and also do good.
And do it in a nice way.
We hear about violence all the time in the news, yet we rarely hear stories about peace. There are so many people who are working hard to promote solutions to violence, toxic polarization, and authoritarianism, often at great personal risk. We never hear about these stories, but at what cost? On Making Peace Visible, We speak with journalists, storytellers, and peace builders who are on the front lines of both peace and conflict. You can find Making Peace Visible wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's take some audience questions. Otherwise, I have like six more questions I can ask. Okay.
Hi, USC alum and in communications. So I hear this thread across many industries, and recently a lot of the DEI movement kind of fizzled out in the last few years. Hearing today everything and in other conferences as well, there's a lot of bubbles that are happening. And I think there's very top level conversations that don't get filtered all the way to the key voters, the key people that are going to make a difference this election. So yes, we tried doing it for many years at a corporation, at a corporate level. How do we go back to getting to the board again and back to the, you know, all-inclusive equality, just the whole diversity question? Like, how do we break through? Because not only, yes, these Nordic countries probably don't have, they don't have the issues we do. We have so many more languages just in California, plus 50 plus. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but I, you know, just putting those thoughts in, how do we break the bubble open to be more inclusive for those folks that do care about the climate?
Yes. Thank you. I think that's a really good question. And it's one that I agree with you that it is often the most difficult when you have the level of diversity. I was a refugee and immigrant to this country, and I'm very, very grateful to be a Tibetan American. And so what I would say is that I think the process of even looking at it, where it's top down, to me is already bifurcated and wrong. I think that we need to have a whole new system altogether where it doesn't have to always filter down. Why does climate movement and climate leadership start with only intellectual physicists from Stanford and MIT? It doesn't have to. It could start from Indigenous Lakota and Cherokee leaders as well. And it should, in fact. And so what I'm seeing with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is that more financing opportunities. That's why I was excited about the $20 billion that was announced today by Biden's administration, is that more financing and more ability for local communities to be empowered so that they can start navigating their own questions. Because climate, in my opinion, humbly, is not one weave. There are many types of climate questions. Some communities are dealing with drought. Others are dealing with immigration. New York City, for example, was just talking to a lot of the citizens there who are the most progressive and who believe in having refugees and climate migrants, but are still worried about safety and are worried about the rise of crime and also stability of their own city. So I think in each hyper-local community, it will be different. And that's how we break through, is by focusing on what needs to be focused in that community.
So many of these communities have been the dumping ground for all of the polluting facilities. And what EDF has tried to do is to empower them, is to give them monitors, for example. In Houston, in the Ship Channel, there are many communities around there that are just decimated by not just air pollution, but by dredging and dumping of chemicals out of the Ship Channel. And what we've tried to do is help them organize. They have good leadership, but they needed tools. And so we gave them a lot of tools. We gave them, they have something that monitors, but it was stationary. So we gave them something that, Google has, you know, little vans that can go around, and they can see where the hotspots are, because the politicians won't listen to them unless they have evidence. So we're trying to help empower these communities on the ground in as many places as we can. And I think that's the right approach, honestly.
Hi, I'm Bonnie Nixon. I'm with the Port of Long Beach at a container terminal. And I really appreciate everything you've all shared, and certainly thank you for your service. You know, we've benefited a lot from the from some of the federal and state funding that has come out in the last couple of years. We're going heavily after the IRA money, and we're very fearful about what could happen towards the end of this year if that gets gutted. I'm curious about your perspective on the Buy America, Build America requirements that are being put in place by this administration. Understand the long-term vision and goal, but in order for us to make it by this 2030, we've outsourced all our production, you know, and in order for us to electrify quickly and get the capacitors, the chargers, the conduit, the equipment here, it's like I don't see new Pittsburghs cropping up around this country, nor communities saying we will be a Pittsburgh.
Right.
You know, so what do we do in the interim?
Well, I think it's both a federal and a state issue. It's even a local issue. So I think I think bottom up is a good place to start. But at some point you're going to need more power than that. So then you have to develop power statewide, and that's much harder to do. But I think there are certainly groups out there that have technical assistance, that can provide technical assistance and can help you navigate, because you guys don't have the capacity to actually do what you need to do. And the only way that you're going to get it is if you can build your organization with the help of others helping you, so that you build your power. That's what this is all about. It's building power from the local level up, and it's very hard to do it from the top down.
I think the concern was, we've learned from the past energy crisis, we were too dependent on foreign countries. And it's a national security issue where the military was really concerned what we were doing here as a country. And then jobs, talking about jobs, this is a really important one. We should have, to the maximum extent possible, frankly, in California or at least in our country, these facilities based here. We saw during COVID what it was like to find out that all our vaccines were made in other countries and we couldn't get anything for 6 months or so. So in-state jobs nationally, right. I say whatever you can do to make that a priority. If there's some agreements, like we had an interesting discussion with the Mexican EV maker that wants to sell cars in our country. Well, that could be a win-win. So I have some flexibility, but I would say to the maximum extent possible, in state or in our country first, it's smart to invest here in the jobs of the future. But there can be agreements with other countries when needed. We are trying to ramp up right now lithium and batteries to have that in state. And that's part of our rollout with switching to EVs. But it's a good question. We have, we get that a lot from people. Yes. We want to have it both ways.
It's a great question.
I'd actually love to comment on this question. I think that this is an important question, because I actually believe, number one, more power to you for doing the Inflation Reduction Act grants or application, because I find it's a very difficult and circuitous process for companies who are trying to navigate even getting a $1 million grant. So I think that that process needs to be streamlined. There are the point about it where you said there's not as many cities like Pittsburgh, I would actually disagree. We have a company we invested in called Block Power. They do vertical integration. Someone just clapped. They do vertical integration for commercial and residential buildings. So they go in the lowest income sometimes neighborhoods, and they, without even getting a loan or a lease, actually through Goldman Sachs, give a lease so that a landlord can actually have a green building. And this actually reduces the rent of an individual up to 42%. It's also found that areas where Block Power is operating in, recidivism and violence has gone down in some communities up to 15 to 20%. Those are reasons why mayors and governors are inviting Block Power to come. When this RFP went out for Block Power to be in cities, there was actually a lot of cities who raised their hand and said, we would love to have hundreds of thousands of jobs. I think the training, the visibility is there. It's just about the opportunity.
I just want to clarify one thing. I think for power, absolutely. What I'm more concerned about is things like steel, iron.
I see.
The raw materials.
Hi, Dr. Stephen Hubbard. I'm a USC alum. It's not a question, just more an avenue for a legal response. So say Trump wins the election and he starts trying to withdraw the waivers. I would say, does the federal government have the ability to roll back a safety standard so that more people are injured? So could he could the federal government mandate that more people die of lung cancer? In other words, could the federal government say, you can't have a seatbelt in a car? You can't have an asbestos standard. So I would just say, think about using that kind of approach as a potential legal challenge to him removing the waiver.
There's a lot of people right now putting their heads together on the state level and the federal level on how to put some preventative measures, like you said, in place. Roll back, but technically you could.
In other words, as a response to the court, the federal government does not have the right to mandate that states hurt people by reducing their safety standards. So thank you.
I wanted to bounce off the previous question of DEI. How can we make sure that we don't use the exponential threat of climate change to make investments that only continue to exacerbate systemic injustices, you know, from continuing reliance on single passenger transportation that result in, you know, urban heat islands, or simply continuing to rely on poor energy infrastructure in already underfunded communities?
So your question is around how do we stop from there being exacerbated climate justice threats? Is that what it is?
To make sure that we don't fall into the same patterns we have for hundreds of years.
I think, unfortunately, some of those problems do remain. I think that where I'll speak to me on venture capital and financing, where I can make a difference, and I do as an investor, is in companies that we take a board seat and companies that Pulse Fund invests in. We actually ask and request these founders, number one, to think through the issue of making sure inclusion and D&I is part of it. I think that private financing and capital has a responsibility and also a power to require there being a diverse board. And when you have a diverse board, you find time and time again, the results are also more inclusive. So I think that is one way that on the private financing end that we do tackle it.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Jonty Pretzer, the founder of Pretzer Green Consulting. We actually do work from the bottom up. I'm a startup company and been reaching out to businesses in the area, looking to go national. So my question, though, comes back to transportation, LA. I actually studied SB 32 quite extensively. Matthew Kahn, environmental economist. You guys might know him because he came here to USC as well.
Totally.
I find it very troubling that we are substituting electric cars for combustion cars. And electric cars are great. I love them, but we still use a lot of petroleum products in those cars. We also, I mean, there is recycling of those vehicles that we claim, but again, there are some things that aren't recyclable, and the batteries can't be 100% recycled, unfortunately. I'd like to see more incentives for employers to hire people locally, right? Like with SB 32 being multi-use communities, should have a mix of business and homes in the area. And lived in Europe for a while, and I'm telling you, there's nothing like walking to work, you know. And maybe a hybrid system, more established, incentivized hybrid system would be great, because with electric vehicles, the traffic is going to continue to be what it is. And despite the ignition technology that's come around with some of the hybrid vehicles and such, I just see it as an ongoing problem. How are we going to deal with the traffic, you know? And so we could just get that going. That'd be great.
I have one quick success story, and appreciate all the comments here. Diesel buses were a big problem and are still a big problem in our area. And so part of the problem is, how do we switch to all electric or zero emission buses, however they're operating? Well, in the LA County area now, this is what we've done. Instead of relying on foreign countries, Proterra in LA and BYD up in Lancaster in LA, they have all electric buses being made here and being used here. They're ramping up the MTA, where it'll be all electric buses, zero emission, no diesel. Lancaster, Palmdale area, 250 electric buses are now on the road. That area has all electric. That Republican mayor out there, and it shouldn't be a partisan issue, went to China, said, if you want to build here, you come over and train my workers. We'll put the plant here in Lancaster. He's got solar panels on all the parking lots, and they're operating that way and successfully. And that's an area that this is not a partisan issue. Mm-hmm. They support all this.
Right.
So eventually it's coming. Boy, we need big thinkers. We need grants. We need it in everyone's communities. But I think you're going to see all electric buses, school buses, and in this area sooner than later. Hopefully by the Olympics.
Thank you. Well, the infrastructure bill has money for electric buses, but not a lot of money. So it's Houston switching to electric buses.
I think it has to be more local initiative get it going.
So I didn't realize that hurt children sitting on the bus more than those if you were sitting outside to be on a diesel-powered school bus.
Well, on that note, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for all your questions and thoughtful comments. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on The Bully Pulpit. It helps us a lot when you subscribe and rate the show 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at USCPOLFuture. That's USCPOLFuture. Follow us on Facebook and YouTube and visit our website for upcoming programs.
This podcast is part of the Democracy Group.